Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the first hour of Jazz for the Asking. Well, it's very nice to have you with us once again on the program. We have a very special show today. We're going to be taking a listen to one of the most legendary singers of the last 100 years. He was a guest previously on a PCJ program and has come back for this special program looking at the American Songbook. Why are we doing this? Well, after we did our interview with Canadian jazz vocalist George Evans, many of you wanted to hear us feature this kind of music again. That's what we have coming up on today's show. But to begin, let's take a listen to Hank Mobley from the album Soul Station. Hank Mobley is on tenor sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakely on drums. Each of those musicians have recorded individually. This is an album from 1960. The track is called Remember by Irving Berlin. Thank you. Hank Mobley on tenor sax, also with Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakely on drums. The track was called Remember, and it's from a 1960 release on Blue Note called Soul Station. At the beginning of the program, I said that we would be featuring the American Songbook today. Well, to be more exact, a singer who has made the American Songbook his life. He has been performing since the late 1940s and has become a legend. He is up there with other great American legends of this music form, such as Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Mel Torme, and others. He was also a guest on the PCJ program, The Happy Station Show. He has returned again to talk about this wonderful music form and his career. That is U.S. singer Steve Lawrence. Many of you will know him as being the other half of Steve and Edie. Our special guest on this edition of Jazz for the Asking is American singer Steve Lawrence.
I've got you under my skin, I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop. Before I begin, I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop. Before I begin, I've got you. I've got you. I've got you. I've got you. Yes, I've got you.
I was doing some research and trying to think, how should I begin this interview? Because you've been in show business for a long time. And the only question that comes to mind, and I don't know if you've ever been asked this as a lead question, but how have you been able to maintain your voice for so long? Because so many singers, except for a few exceptions, maybe like Mel Torme and a few others, have been able to maintain their voice in such good condition.
Well, first of all, let me say that you're right. I have never been asked that question, especially as a leadoff question. But to truthfully answer that, I really wouldn't know where to begin. I guess maybe genetics might be a piece of that. I don't smoke to speak of, and I don't drink in excess. I drink socially, and I don't abuse my voice. I think Maybe that has something to do with it. And I think my dad was a cantor. I don't know if you know what that is. But he did a lot of cantorial religious singing, and I grew up as a choir boy.
Mm-hmm.
So this came to me kind of quite naturally, and the outgrowth was like, as opposed to an old movie that Al Jolson made called The Jazz Singer, I went into the world of popular music after I heard my first Frank Sinatra record when I was about 13, 15 years old or whatever, you know. So I just thought, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. But and it's a funny thing about liturgic music, you know, like when it has no respect for octaves or range. You know, you could go from the bottom end of your vocal abilities to the top end and stretch it. So that probably was some great training for me as well, because it's not as regimented and not as organized in a sense as pop music is. You know, popular music, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and usually it's eight bars, and then the next eight bars are repeated, and then there's a bridge which separates it musically and lyrically from the rest of it, and then they come back and repeat it. So there's a form to pop music, but in religious singing and training, they couldn't care less about eight bars now and later. You know, you're at one end to the other, you know. Edie had a similar training too, but she had a natural gift, and I think maybe a piece of that, if I could throw that in, that might be a little bit of a natural gift as well. On top of the fact that I really never really abused it, so that's the only way I really can possibly think of answering that. You know,
at any point, because I know that you. You know, a lot of people would not know your Jewish name, and I think a lot of people wouldn't be able to pronounce it. But when you were singing in a choir and your father being a cantor, was there ever any pressure on you to maybe even go into that direction?
Not in the slightest. It was never discussed, and I guess maybe he probably assumed on his part, although, as I said, we never talked about it, he probably thought that I would, since I was doing that as a choir boy, I might just extend it and go into that. But when I first started to show signs of being influenced and wanting to go for and being very affected by the world of the American popular songbook, he just said, you know, do what you like, son. He said, you know, just go wherever your heart takes you, because music is, all kinds of music is wonderful, and you'll be a very happy camper, not cantor. You'll be a very happy camper with that in mind, because music is just love from the soul, and it's just do whatever it is you want to do. Just make sure it's something you're happy to get up and go to work and do.
When you said just a moment ago that when you heard your first Frank Sinatra record, which had influenced you. Yeah. What was it like for you, you know, many years later, being able to perform with him and be on stage? Did Frank look at you as being like a son, like, you know, the younger guy who's come along?
Probably, but we never talked about it. I think he always looked at me as the up and coming generation behind him. But I must say, he really was like a beacon for all of us who came after him in the world of popular music. And all of us, we would not be truthful if we didn't say that he had some influence on all of us who came after him, because not that you did an impression of him or tried to sound like him, but his approach to a pop song became more of like a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a beginning, a middle, and an end, and he was the first to pay attention to the lyric content, more importantly than up until then, you know, they were singing like, hey, it had to be you, I wanted, and he took that and meant it had to be you. You know, he made it, he could be singing to thousands of people, but everybody thought that he was just singing to that one person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great ability that he had, so that he took that, and he was primarily a great storyteller, and that bled over very easily for him into his acting career. I mean, Frank made 60 or more films through his career. Most of them were pretty darn good. There was a couple he'd like to take back, I'm sure, as we all have done professionally in film or on records. You know, you hear records that you made years ago, you say, why in the world did I record that? But at the time, it seemed like a good idea, you know. But and also, the record business was different in those days. I don't know if you recall, but the A&R meant, Keith, but that meant it stood for artist and repertoire. And every record company had an A&R division. So when you were getting a record, they would garner a lot of material out there from writers and publishers, and you all had mutual agreements. So, and in those days, we recorded live with the orchestra in the studio, and you would do 4 songs on a 3-hour record date. So, you know, that was today. Today they go in and they spend 6 months on one song. You know, they have the technology today is such where they can literally record one instrument or just add one note or take it out, and they spend, you know, they advertise the fact, my first studio album in 12 years, like it's a big deal. You know, so those of us who grew up in that time, when you had to finish an album in 3 days of recording, so it was different, you know. But it also, I think, it put a gun to your head, and there's something about having a deadline. Mm-hmm. George Burns, oh, I'm sure you've heard of George Burns, but he put it probably best. You know, they kept asking him how long he's going to keep performing. He says, hey, and he was like 97 at the time. He says, well, I have to open at Caesar's Palace in 2 months. He says, everybody should have an opening. You know, you can't just rehearse the rest of your life. You have to have an opening night, an opening day, whatever. So, you know, over the years, I've had the good fortune of getting to meet a lot of people I grew up tremendously admiring. And years later, when Frank and I became really friends and got to call each other by first names, and I would sit down and, you know, just have a lunch with him or have a drink with him, or Edie and I had a beach house out in Malibu, California, and he wanted to rent. We had the same manager, so he knew we were working all summer. So he wanted to rent my house for the summer. I said, well, you can't rent my house. You could stay there. You and Barbara could stay. He says, no, kid. I want to rent your house. I said, you cannot rent my house. He says, no, you want to stay there? Please, my pleasure. So we went back and forth. He stayed there, but he's an extraordinarily generous and gracious man. He bought my kid a gift. I wouldn't even begin to tell you. I mean, he really is a very special man and unique in many ways. I had the pleasure of, I heard that he had a dark side. I fortunately was never exposed to that. So I only knew him from the wonderful contribution that he made to the world of popular music and to films, and the influence that he had on all of us younger kids who came after him. And, you know, and I used to play cards with him on Sunday. I must tell you, growing up in the shadows of this musical giant, then becoming his friend, and then sitting at a poker table with Frank Sinatra and Gregory Peck and Kirk Douglas and Jack Lemmon, I mean, I'm looking at these people, and it dawned on me that I was the only one at the table I never heard of. You know, it was incredible that I'm sitting with these idols of mine, and we have become friends. And that, to me, meant a great deal, that you're on a first-name basis, you could tell each other whatever you felt like, and your tastes and your wants and needs ran along the same lines, and it was really a wonderful time. Unfortunately, I think a lot of that camaraderie is no longer exists in the business today. I find that everybody is so much by themselves and into their own world, and probably maybe that's why they're getting into a lot of trouble too, these kids. I don't know.
You know, like all the rumors about Frank, I mean, my feeling has always been, you know, like he was extremely famous, and people love to gossip and just say all kinds of gobbledygook, and half of it I don't believe anyway, because other musicians that I spoke to, including recently Johnny Mann of the Johnny Mann Singers, who had worked with Frank on a couple of sessions, we talked about this, and he said, oh, a lot of it is just gobbledygook because people are jealous, you know. But
he was an easy target, you know. You know, you say Frank Sinatra, and you say something derogatory about him, and people are listening like you knew what you were talking about.
Yeah.
But, you know, if he did say something derogatory about someone, I'm sure he had a reason for it.
Yeah.
But as I said, I never was exposed to that, because we always had good times and good fun, and we traveled the world with him for a year. Edie and I went literally to around the globe with him, and no matter where in the world we were, he was Frank Sinatra. In Italy, they knew him from his records and his. In Japan, they couldn't speak English, but they came there with his albums. They were singing the songs with him. I've got you under my skin, yeah, Frank. You know, boom, boom, boom. And then they come backstage and say, "Oh, they got the money. They got the funny stuff." It was incredible that they knew him professionally, internally, and externally. He was really. He sang for six generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he had children, their mothers, their grandmothers, their great grandmothers. I mean, it was. I can't think of anybody else that went through that professionally, and gracefully, and made the contribution that he has on many levels. And it's just, I was just happy to have him as a friend, and as a mentor. I just was really very fond of him. And I always made him laugh, which killed me, because he just loved laughing and jokes and things like that. He couldn't tell a joke to save himself, but he loved hearing it. You know? But he had a good sense of humor. I mean, he would see things funnily, but he just couldn't say, you know, these two guys got off a streetcar. And he just couldn't tell he couldn't tell a joke, you know. But he really had a good sense of humor and loved good times. And, and he was bigger than life. I mean, you know, we'll never see the likes of him again, but fortunately for us and for generations to come, he leaves behind the greatest legacy in American popular music. I mean, mm-hmm. He's just a very special guy on a lot of different levels.
Let's talk about the music industry for a change, you know, for a moment, because you were talking about, you know, the A&R man, and I've interviewed a number of people about this, and they said it was the kind of thing where they would get a call from the record company saying, "We have this song, we want you to do it." During that period, it was the A&R men and the producers and all the suits and executives that really had a lot of say over what the artist was recording. At any point when you were recording stuff, maybe like Party Doll, did you just go and think to yourself, "What are these people doing?"
Very often, as a matter of fact. That's why I think the word came into being and was signed in, and was put into contracts, where the material, they said it was mutual agreement. So since you were doing four sides, you could object to two. And do two. The company said, "This is going to be a hit, do it." And, well, I like these two songs, so you would do the two songs that you brought to the table. And they brought two songs to the table. Sometimes they were pretty good, and sometimes they were not. But you had to do what was called mutual agreement. And in some cases, the song may have gotten great recognition and become a turntable hit or even sold well, but it was something that you just, you know, you were not too thrilled about. If you had your druthers, you probably would not have done it. But you know, somebody always comes up and says, "Hey, I love that song you did." And they name a song that you try to hide. You know, you say, "No, that wasn't me. That was somebody else." Or something.
Yeah, I you know, not too long ago, I interviewed Miss Shirley Bassey, and she said that when she first initially recorded Goldfinger, she hated the song.
Yes, I know.
It made her cringe, but she said now it's become so identifiable with her that she said she still sings it, but she says she remembers that I still hate the song.
She was quite a dame, boy. She really was. She still is. I mean, God love Goldfinger. She was bigger than life too. She really was, and a great artist, a great performer, by the way.
So, you know, getting back to that, I mean, when you and Edie first recorded "This Could Be the Start of Something Big," which was composed by Steve Lawrence and people,
Steve
you
Allen.
Know, Steve by sorry by Steve Lawrence, Steve Allen, you know, Steve Allen was not just great on television, but he was also a very good composer and wrote some very wonderful songs. Of course, this is the song that is most identifiable with him. How did this song come about? Did he say, you know, "I'd like you to do this on the show," and then the record company said, "Oh, we want to release it as a single"?
Steve was extraordinarily talented on many levels. First of all, he was one of the brightest people you'd ever want to sit in a room and talk to, and he was a wit, funny as heck, and he was an author. He wrote something like 52 books. Some were novels and some were stories, And I learned so much from him, because in the early years of the Tonight Show, Steve created what became the Tonight Show in America, And he that whole format of behind a desk and then having people sit and interview and talk and get up and perform. And the only difference was that he had a steady group of players on the show. Namely, we had an orchestra that was always there. Orchestra, we had 5-6 musicians originally, but then when they got to the network, they expanded the band. But Edie and I were the boy and girl singer where we met on that show. And so I have a great deal to be thankful for him, to him. And he had a show on, I don't know if you ever saw it or not, but Keith, there was a show in this country called Meeting of the Minds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was on public broadcasting here. And what he did with that was extraordinary. And he would take people from history. It was like a talk show. But he would take, Thomas Jefferson. He'd have an actor portraying Thomas Jefferson, another guy playing Julius Caesar, another guy portraying Jesus Christ, another guy playing Albert Edison. And he did tremendous research on how they felt about things, and he put it in today's milieu, except they were dressed in character. And it was a talk show around a table. And they were talking about whatever it was, the economy, or how they felt about the certain political situations, or the world, or religion, and here, based upon the writings of let's say Thomas Jefferson, how he felt about it, the actor would express. Steve wrote out what his expression was on that. It was such a brilliant idea that nobody could stop watching it. But it was on public broadcasting and didn't really generate a big audience on that. But I always thought it was terrific.
So when you did that song for the first time...
By the way, he wrote that song. This could be the start of something big, as not only for me and Edie to do on the show, but he also he used to use it a lot as one of the themes of his show. So, and it became so identified with us, with the record and all, that that was like the first big record that we had together, you know. This could be the start of something big, and it really was. And I will forever be grateful to him for all the experience that Edie and I individually and collectively garnered on that show. The last thing we were called upon to do was sing. He threw us into sketches, or they were hitting us with pies, putting us in ovens. I mean, it was nuts. We were standing on top of the RCA building singing, or under a swimming pool, or jumping. We did remotes from different parts of the country live. At that point, it was unheard of. And the director, Dwight Hemian, was the first guy to use that blue psych. So I was doing once a song called "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes," and in front of a blue psych, and he had me shrunk down to the size of a cigarette, and I was singing it on top of an ashtray. it was nuts. And also, he was very picture conscious. Dwight was probably one of the best directors I've ever worked with in my life, and he would always say at the end of the song, you know, Steve, turn around and just walk upstage, and I'll pull the camera back and we'll fade. And I was so used to, you know, singing in a nightclub or in a theater. I said, can I take a bow to the audience at the end of the show? He says, come on, Stevie, we've had this conversation. This is television. You're not, you know, it's not a saloon. It's not a nightclub. You're doing something. He says, so I love you, so I'll pull back. You turn around and fade to black and start to walk upstage. So and it really bothered me, you know, as a performer, that I didn't acknowledge the applause at the end of the song. So after doing this for a couple of years, I said to him, you know, Dwight, you created a very strange happening in my life. He said, what's that? I said, well, when I walk in the street, people don't recognize me till I pass them. When I walk past them and they see me walking by, I say, hey, aren't you on
was it passing them, or was it like, you know, somebody would look at you and go, I think I know you, but could I put a pie in your face to make sure?
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see you back. Yeah, it was just but it was a great time in television when it was live. Mistakes that were made to this day, people say, I saw the show the night that this happened and that happened. You know, now you have the luxury of tape, and if somebody makes a mistake, you go back and do it again. But I tell you, there was something very terrific about making an honest mistake, or, you know, like Edie and I both individually and collectively, like we knew 1,000 different songs, you know. So, but there were some that, you know, we weren't quite sure of because they were lengthy songs, like a long song like Begin the Begin or something like that. So they would use cue cards on the side, and I would occasionally refer to it if I wasn't sure, you know. And everybody was a comic on the show. Everybody was a clown. Nick Vanoff, who started out on our show, became later a very successful producer. But Nicky held cue cards on the show. And he'd flip the cards when they begin, the beginner brings back the night of music's attender. The second card would be in French. The third card was in Hebrew. The fourth card was in Italian. So I was having to fight for my life. And I always said to this day, Cole Porter doesn't know how many songs I wrote with him.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel like spring is sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to go and play hide and seek. I want to go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. You and I, we're just like a couple of tots running across a meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots. You make me feel so young. You make me feel there are songs to be sung, bells to be rung, and a wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do today, 'cause you make me feel so young. You make me young. You make me feel that spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to go and play hide and seek. I want to go and bounce that moon just like a toy balloon. 'Cause you and I, we're just like a couple of tots running around the meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots. You make me young. You make me feel there are songs to be sung, bells to be rung, and a wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do this here day, because you make me feel so. You make me feel so. You make me feel so young.
American singer Steve Lawrence. Steve is our special guest on this edition of Jazz for the Asking. If you have any comments, suggestions for shows, please write us at the email address that I'll give later on in the program. I also invite you to visit our website at www.pcj.com/JFTA, or just go to the website and click on Jazz for the Asking. We now continue our conversation with American legendary singer Steve Lawrence.
But when you were doing the early televisions with Steve Allen, and you know, I've seen the stuff that you did with Carol Burnett on her show with you and Edie, and there's something that I think is the magic, especially of the two of you together, and in as solos, is that there's a certain amount of humor that you have been able to do Because when, you know, it's I've heard that, you know, the people say, you know, Steve and Edie are Hollywood's happiest couple. And that comes across in screen either when you're performing together or on solo and you're performing in comedy, because both of you do have very good timing when it comes to comedy. Then that must have been something that you learned with Steve Allen.
Well, Steve has a great deal to do with that, because I, you know, every night, we were on Monday to Friday. Originally, the program was an hour and 45 minutes long. We went on at 11:15. In those days, it was only 15 minutes worth of news. Today, they're on 24/7. You know, so the news went on from 11 to 11:15. We went on from 11:15 to 1 o'clock in the morning. And Steve is open and says, "Well, I'm sure there's nobody watching that. This, it doesn't matter. So I'll just take a nap and just, you know, whatever it was." You know, but before I joined the Steve Allen Show, and I had a record or two out on King Records. And I started to get some offers for employment to work in nightclubs. And I was the opening act for so many different comedians. And I just admired the guts that these guys had to get up there alone by themselves, no music helping them, and just get out there and say, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the club tonight. And they'd have to be funny for a half hour or 40 minutes or whatever they were doing, you know. So my regard for the guy who gets up in one and has to be funny, and the guys who do it very well, I had the pleasure of opening for so many of them, from Milton Berle down to whomever, or up to Sagres, whoever. I worked with all of them, and that was a great training for me, too. I used to sit and watch them in the wings all the time and how they reacted to an audience, their timing. And Steve Allen, of course, was the greatest show, because I was there every night. And it was fun to go, you know, it was a live show. We went on, as I said, 11:15 at night. So we didn't have to come in till like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and just fake a song that we were going to do that night, because we had no money for arrangements. The show didn't have a budget for that. So we would just pick our keys and do it, and the guys would fake and comp, you know, just make an ending at the end of the song. So, but we used to come in like, you know, like 11, 12 o'clock and just hang around. It just, everybody had such laughs and such good times. It was such friendships, you know, developed on that show. And I just, as a matter of fact, as I'm talking to you now, Keith, I'm looking at a baby picture of Steve Allen on my office wall. Years ago, I started collecting baby pictures of friends of mine in the business. And Steve Allen, I have Steve Allen's baby picture. There's so many friends of mine in the business, but Steve, you look at him and say, "Yeah, that was him."
Does he have the glasses?
No glasses. If he did, he wasn't wearing them. But he's wearing a cute little collar, and it looked like a little photo, not photo, but a cute little white collar and a. It was black and white picture, of course, in those days. It was like, I guess it was a gray shirt. It could have been a color, but it looks great.
When you're performing a song, something which is an art that seems to be lost nowadays, but, you know, there's an art of performing the song. It's not just a matter of singing it, which tends to happen now, but when you're singing songs by George Gershwin, Cole Porter, and Irving Berlin, and so many other great composers, there is a certain amount of performance in it. Is that something that before you let's say would sing, let's say She Loves Me or Night and Day, that you work on in your head? How am I going to not just sing it but also perform it?
Sure, I think the first thing, if you're doing your job properly, when you you know, a good song is like they call it, it's a perfect marriage between the melodic and the lyric. When if it's a song that's whether it's a love song or a song of any kind of passion or a spiritual thing or whatever, and there's a build in it, so that there's a build lyrically and then musically that supports, and then the orchestration comes in, and the arranger becomes a very big key figure to this too, so that when you're singing this, he's supporting you underneath, and when you're getting more passionate or more dramatic, that music is pushing you over the top. Or if everybody does their job right, then the listener will be affected by what you're trying to do. But I think the first thing that comes, you read it too. I mean, you read the song just as a poem or as a story. from the beginning, a middle, and an end. And once you get the message in the song and you get the melody to it, so sometimes you might have to trust your phrasing, because the melodic line may be a little sooner than you'd like to say that word. Like, I think about, and then it's like, I think about you, maybe the way it was written. But you might sing it like, I think about you, or I think about you. You know what I'm saying? There's mm-hmm. a lot of ways in which to make a statement, whether it's a statement of love or passion or hate or spiritual or whatever, you know.
But there must be times when you look at a song and you wonder, you know, I can't do anything with this. Has that ever happened?
To most of the songs that are out there today, I have tried in vain, I might ask, I try to find out what these kids are hearing that I'm not. And forget about rap, because I can't get with that at all. First of all, I can't make out the words. I can't make, all it is they should build a monument to the drummer or the drum machine. but I just, you know, going to tell you, baby, that whatever the lyric content is, I can't hear it. It goes by too quickly. Words are clipped. Their enunciation or pronunciation of the language, I don't know. But these kids understand it. I watch sometimes passing on the television show. They got some rap artists doing it, and they have shots of people in the audience, and they're mouthing the words with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be me. No, it's another time and space. That's probably what it is. This is their time and their music, and there's a big audience out there who still likes to hear a beautiful melody and some lovely lyric written beautifully and something that makes sense and hits you at the right time. And there's a lot to be said for, because most of the songwriters when I was growing up, a lot of them were very brilliant, bright, well-educated, and some of them never got out of the third grade, but they had a gift, instinct. You know, but people like Cole Porter went to they were college graduates. Irving Berlin was a kid in the streets. So it didn't matter where and how it came, whether it was a gift and a natural ability or whether it was intellect and the formation in education. But however it came, it was there. I mean, and they had words that today, if you were to have them in conversation, the kids would look at you. They would know what you're talking about.
Well, you know, it's funny. If you think back to some of the early rock and roll songs that you recorded in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, you could probably think that maybe people of a certain generation back then were looking at you and go, what is Party Doll? What is all this?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And there's a lot of songs like that. You know, I would have liked to have had out under another assumed name or had another chance to argue why it shouldn't be done.
Mm-hmm. So when,
but those things happen professionally, you know.
When did you and Edie take the decision, okay, you know what, we're not going to do this pop stuff anymore, we're going to focus on the American songbook?
I think that probably happened to us when we got to Edie and I and Don Costa started ABC Paramount Records. Then we were there and got them on their legs, and I think since we were at the in the beginning of the incubated period, you know, we had a little more to say about it. So we were there at the formation of the company. We also were there at the formation of United Artists Records. But I think when we got to Columbia, there was more of a regard. Goddard Liebeson was running the company, and Clive Davis was just a new lawyer out of law school, and he was hired there. And he's become extremely successful at what he's done. But he came on, but when we came to Columbia Records, we had a reputation already. So that probably came into play as well. I think we made less bad records at Columbia than we did prior to that. But I think when people have a regard for your abilities and your taste and you make your point, it's a much easier conversation to have.
Singer Steve Lawrence on this edition of Jazz for the Asking. We will have a short break. When we come back, our continuing conversation with Steve. If you wish to get in touch with us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. To close off the first hour of the program, a song that is connected with Steve and Edie in more ways than one. It was their first hit and became a song that was connected with them for the remainder of their career, and still is today. The song was composed by Steve Allen, and it's called This Could Be the Start of Something Big, here on Jazz for the Asking. Stay tuned, we have more right after this.
You're walking along the street, or you're at a party, or else you're alone, and then you suddenly dig. You're looking in someone's eyes, you suddenly realize that this could be the start of something big. You're lunching at 21 and watching your diet, declining a Charlotte Russe, accepting a fig. When out of a clear blue sky, it's suddenly gallon guy, and this could be the start of something big. There's no controlling the unrolling of your fate, my friend. Who knows what's written in a magic book?
But when a lover you discover at the gate, my friend, invite her in without a second look.
You're up in an aeroplane, or dining at Sardi's, or lying at Malibu alone on the sand. You suddenly hear a bell, and right away you can tell that this could be the start of something grand.
This could be the start of something very big. Why don't you play your part? Please give your heart to me and see. This could be the start of something wonderful. Why don't you take a chance? Just try a romance with me and see.
Watching the sun come up, counting your money,
money,
or else in a dim cafe, you're ordering wine. Then suddenly there he is, and you want to be where he is.
And this must be the start of something. This could be the heart of something. This could be the start of something big.